Welcome to the Bad Apples Episode 19, Season 3. My name is Klaatu. In this episode, I'll be talking about KDE 4.2, Debian 5.0, taking some listener feedback, and probably, I don't know, some other stuff. So stay tuned. First of all, I should explain my absence, if you noticed. You might not have noticed, since I don't seem to be one of those people who releases on a terribly regular basis. But, yeah, I've been sick for a couple of weeks, like about 2 weeks. Nothing major, but, you know, sick enough so that my voice did not sound like itself. So if you heard episode 300 of Hacker Public Radio, where they had a couple of the hosts answer some questions, you might have noticed or might not have noticed that mine sounded very subdued, and maybe I didn't quite sound like myself. At least I don't sound like myself to myself. That would be why I did that when I had a sore throat and I was barely intelligible to myself. But so yes, that is why I've not been podcasting. I've been absent for about 2 episodes of the Linux Cranks and just didn't get a chance to do anything on this show either. So that's where I've been. That's why I've been absent. That's my excuse. Now, in the meantime, in the time that I've been away, some major things have happened. 2 releases that I really was excited about and wanted to mention and comment on, and now, even though I will comment on them, they are hardly what you would consider breaking news at this point. But that's okay. I've never been really that much into doing the whole breaking news thing, so I don't really mind just kind of commenting after the fact. But one of the major things was, of course, KDE 4.2 was released. KDE 4.2 is all I can say about it, and I know it's not polite to say this, but everyone out there, I told you so. I told you so, I told you so, I told you so. People were panicking, they were jumping ship, they were talking about how KDE was dead, how they'd changed everything and they'd really screwed everything up. The guy who started Linux published a statement saying that he'd switched from KDE. You know, everyone was saying, oh, KDE 4, just, I can't deal with it, I have to get away from it. I kept telling them, give it a couple of versions, and it's going to be incredible. Now, let me give you a little bit of history on the way operating systems work. And I know KDE is not an OS, it's more of an environment, but let's just use terms loosely right now, and let's just say KDE plus Linux equals, you know, the OS that we're talking about. All right, so way back when, probably around 2000 or whatever, Apple, the system that I used to use before using Linux, released a drastic change to their operating system. They changed from whatever, I think it was Pascal-based, something like that, OS 9. I don't really know what it was based on, but it was very specific to Macintosh. OS 9, it was the Mac OS, basically. And with version 10, they went to the whole Unix-based model and completely changed their user interface. And 10.0 was their first release, and it was they did a public beta at first, and then they released it to the general public. And, you know, my dad, being the diehard Mac user he is, was one of the beta testers. He got the public beta, tried it out, he installed 10 on a partition of his computer, and of course the thing was completely unusable. It had no applications except maybe text edit. It had no drivers except for a couple of very specific, you know, Apple manufactured peripherals. It was a complete change, and people stuck with it. And by 10.2, it was more or less usable. 10.3, no one remembers. 10.4, it became, you know, a proper operating system that you could actually use with respect. That's just how it works. The 1.0, the X.0 release of something is not going to be the version that you're going to stick with forever. You're not going to say, oh, this is perfect, I'll never upgrade, this is the version I like. That's just how it is. And with KDE 4, the same is true. The team did everyone the favor of continuing support for the 3.5.x series and pushed forward with 4.0 and pushed forward really quite quickly. I mean, I was just in Mountain View this time last year looking at the release of 4.0. And now we're all the way up to 4.2, and it has really, really arrived. It's really where it needs to be at this point. It's got all the features, at least that I can think of, that anyone would want from KDE. And they're adding more features every day. So if you are one of those people who use some feature that, you know, I don't use, and I haven't noticed it missing, I mean, they're releasing the new features all the time. And 4.2 fixes so many issues, so many problems. I don't see what people could possibly complain about 4.x anymore. 4.2 is where it needs to be. It's really, really fantastic. Let's see, starting from the top, they've improved the notification system. And this, I think I either mentioned it on the podcast, or maybe I just blogged about it, or neither, I don't remember. But I saw this on Ivan Kuchik's, I'm probably saying his name wrong, his blog, where I'm pretty sure he was the one working on these new dialog boxes, basically. And they're black, and they're really beautiful looking, but they're small, and they don't take up, you know, 2/3 of your screen like the old notifications and dialog boxes in both 3.5.x and 4.0 through 1.x. They're quite reasonably sized. They're very noticeable. They always pop up down on the lower left, the lower right hand corner. So they're, you know, you don't have to, your eyes aren't searching your entire screen for it. So it's really well done. That's something that I'm really impressed with so far. That's been a noticeable improvement to me. Another thing that they've improved is the entire kicker. So this big panel down at the bottom or the top or the side, wherever you put your kicker. First of all, they've added kind of a pseudo transparency to it, which is kind of slick. That looks really nice. It defaulted to sort of a bluish hue for mine because I have the default Fedora 10 wallpaper on my MacBook, which single boots Fedora 10, of course. So that looks really nice. They've improved the device plasmoid, the device notification thing, where you plug in a CD drive or an external hard drive or a thumb drive, and it pops up here. It's kind of the HAL notification center. It's really quite nice. It gives you exactly what kind of media it is. It tells you how many actions are available for this kind of device, whether you can eject it or mount it or whatever. And it seems to be quite reliable. The former versions, like if you'd put in certain kinds of thumb drives, you know, with that weird partition, what do they call it, the S3 partition or whatever, so that it auto-launches for Windows machines. I had some trouble with that sometimes, and I haven't had any problems with that with a new one, so they must have done some work on that. They have added, well, they've kept the task manager essentially the same, except that, for instance, if I'm in Firefox and I go to download an attachment, or if I just open up another window, you know, for Firefox, not a new tab, just a whole other window, then down on the task manager, a little dot 2 appears. So it says Firefox, but there are two instances or two windows within that application. And then I can click on that, and it will give me a choice as to which window I want to actually bring to the front and make active. So that's quite nice. I like that feature a lot. There are the thumbnails are improved when you roll over each little task. And even more than that, the animation is really, really smooth. So if I roll from one task to another, the little thumbnail just whisks over with me. It's really, really smooth, really smart looking. It's really cool, actually. And the same thing if I go to add a widget, for instance, on that little, everyone calls it the cashew, on the upper right-hand corner. It's actually a little plasma blob. But if I click on that to add something, the animation of the options that I have, that appearing comes in really, really smoothly. It's really neat. And, of course, it has transparency. The system tray, or whatever that is, with the little applets and stuff, has now been sort of partitioned off into its own little space, which is a vast improvement. In the former versions, not so much in 4.1, I never noticed it, but in 4.0, I remember, if, for instance, if I started kget to torrent something, that would add an applet down there. And then if I quit it, that would obviously make the applet go away. But what would happen in 4.0, that sometimes it wouldn't keep track of like how many applets I have, so it would leave space for the kget even though there's no kget there. And then maybe if I unplug my AC adapter and it would tell me that it was going to battery power, that would mess it up. And so in the end you'd get like these really weirdly spaced applets and stuff like that. No longer, that is all fixed. It's all contained in its own little tray, and it's very independent of the rest of the kicker, and it doesn't mess anything up. It looks really nice. It works really well. And the entire kicker in general, there are no more issues with it. I mean, if anyone's got a problem with the kicker, it's just because, I don't know, I really don't know how they would have a problem with it. You can add widgets, you can lock widgets, you can do more settings, you can make it auto-hide, you can resize it, you can center it, align it, you can move it to the side, you can move it to the top, you know, you can do whatever you want to with it. It doesn't, I don't think there's any way to complain about the kicker anymore. So that's a good thing, because I was getting a little bit tired of hearing people complain about that. You can add as many plasmoids, little widgets to it as you want. I have a button here next to my desktops to all, you know, the four virtual desktops that they give you. I have a little dolphin shortcut, I guess you'd call it. It's a little icon of the file manager. I could put like show desktop if I wanted to. That would whisk everything away so that I could just see my desktop, things like that. Speaking of the desktop, one of the complaints that a lot of people had was that the desktop couldn't show icons. First of all, I never had a problem with that because I don't like icons on my desktop. Now, with 4.1 series, they introduced this concept of a transparent folder view so that you could say, okay, here's a widget, and this widget is a look inside of my desktop folder or my documents folder or any folder, really. A lot of people seemed to do the desktop. That was what it was by default on Fedora 10. And I've left that up just, I don't know. I don't know why, actually. I just left it up. And so you've got a little, you know, you've got icons and a little scroll bar. And so you do, in a way, have icons on your desktop. You can go a step further, however, by clicking on the plasmoid, you know, add plasmoid button on the upper right-hand corner, the cashew, as people call it. You right-click on that and you go to appearance settings. And that brings up your desktop settings, Plasma workspace. And right at the top, there's something called type. And right now it's set to desktop, which is the default view of the KDE desktop. So it's just the desktop. Now you can also do a folder view, and that displays the content of your desktop folder out on your desktop. So you will really have icons on your desktop. Do I want that? No, I don't. But if other people do, you certainly can. So that is something that you can do now. Let's see, what else have they done? It's been a problem, 4.0 through 4.1.x, that there's just, it's white on white, or 10% gray on white, and there's just not any easy way to distinguish one window from another. But in KDE 4.2, they finally added a nice little blue single pixel outline around the windows, and now you can tell one window from the other. Admittedly, that took them a while to get to, but it's done now, and it's a vast improvement. Thank you, KDE team, for doing that. That's very helpful. Well, they've actually improved Dolphin quite a bit. Unfortunately, I do not recall exactly what Dolphin looked like before I modified it for myself, so I can't really say what they did exactly, but I do know that I'm pretty sure they've added a filter, or this might have already existed and I just never noticed it, or never had it turned on, but there's a filter now so that if I'm out, let's say I'm in my documents folder, and then I know I want to look for all the documents about Blender, so I can type in Blender, and that filters it down to, that filters everything down in within that folder to just things with the word Blender in their name. So that's really cool. You've got, there's a scale slider that you can add to Dolphin so that you can adjust the size of the icons and text pretty quickly. And obviously, Dolphin is very, very configurable, just as you would expect. It's from a Linux, you know, popular Linux desktop environment. There's a preview pane that you can use so that when you roll over something, it'll show you the preview, it'll show you information about it. This is the whole contextual desktop idea that they have, where data kind of relates to other data. That's kind of nifty. You can turn on the search function. I believe it is called, I will have to look, Strigi, maybe a desktop file indexer, which indexes all your files, as well, you know, the contents as well as the actual names of of that. I don't have that turned on. I don't really want to, so I'm not going to, but it is there. They've got a side panel on the left-hand side of Dolphin that you can have, where it's kind of a tree view of your file system. This I don't use. If you click on the breadcrumb trail, the leftmost folder in the breadcrumb trail, it'll give you the more or less the basic tree view of your file system, at least insofar as the main places, like the root folder, the home folder, whatever kind of media you have plugged in, things like that. So I don't bother with the side panel. I like to maximize the use of my screen. I don't really like to have a whole huge file manager thing going on. So I don't bother with that so much. And eventually I'll get rid of the menu up at the top as well, simply because I don't think I need that either, to be honest. So I keep my Dolphin really, really, really simple. But it's really, really powerful now. I don't, I used to not really love it that much, but honestly, I'm really good with it now. I can't really think of any issues that I have with it at this point. Conqueror, I use it sometimes as a web browser, and I don't know, honestly, I mean, I don't really use it that much anymore. I use Firefox and Dolphin seem to be kind of what I'm doing. And I know that a lot of people were really, really into Conqueror, and unfortunately, I never was one of those power Conqueror users, so I don't feel like I can really comment on the functionality of Conqueror 4 versus 3.5. I'm just not, I guess I was never that much a hardcore user of Conqueror. Plasmoids, I've actually started using widgets a little bit more than I used to now. Still not quite sure how often I want to use them or need to use them or need to have them up, but I've actually been using them more often now. And the KDE team has been adding a lot of different widgets pretty much every other week, I think. I mean, I'll open up add widgets just to see what's going on, and you know, sure enough, there just always seems to be a new widget out, and it's really nice. There's a CPU monitor now. There's a dictionary that actually works now. For some reason, they don't have it. It's kind of a large widget. I don't know why. Like, for something that could be very small and then expand as needed, they keep it kind of large. So I'm not really sure the purpose for that. Maybe it's just I don't really know anything about programming plasmoids, so maybe that's just something that they have to do. But it's all resizable, so it doesn't matter. There's a calculator, again, resizable. There's a weather widget that's really great. It has lots of information on it. And a moon, a phase of the moon widget, which I like a lot because it shows you the phase of the moon, how many days to the new moon, things like that. So that's kind of neat. The real winner, I think, is the CPU monitor. I've been liking that a lot. And I know I could get a CPU monitor on there with Conky and all that other stuff. And I've been meaning to play around with that. I don't know. I just haven't. And suddenly there was a widget there for it. So I don't know. It's a matter of simplicity, I guess. Just added it, and I've actually been enjoying seeing it. So yeah, all that stuff is really good. I'm trying to think of anything else. Oh yeah, the kickstart menu, or whatever they're calling it these days. The menu, obviously you can always right click on it and go to the classic menu style, which is fine if you want to do that. I stayed with the kickstart menu because I did like the way that it can just search. You know, I don't have to look through the menu. I can just type the name of the application and it'll find it for me, and it'll allow me to launch it. So I like that a lot. The one thing I didn't like is the lack of contrast. But now they fixed that. They made the sort of the background of the Kickstart menu black, and the panels within it are white. So you can not only tell what tab you're in, but again, the animation is smoother, and then you can navigate through it easier now, I find. Like if I go into graphics, I see all my graphic programs, and then the big bar on the left says go back, and I can go back. It's really simple, in my opinion. Now, similar to that, and probably something that I use almost more than that, is KRunner, which is the you know, you just type in the application that you want to start, and it starts. It's kind of like GNOME Do is what GNOME uses. So it's just like that. But it's got a lot of different and really cool options. It'll do math for you. It will search your bookmarks. It will search your address book if you want it to. You know, you can have it search whatever you want to. And the way you do that, the way you configure that is, well, the way that you get KRunner going is you hit Alt F2 and it appears in the middle of your screen, and you can type in whatever program. So if I type in Blender, it gives me two different options. It gives me run Blender or go to the CD in my CD drive, which is a Blender CD, a CD with Blender models on it. So there you go. Now, if you want to configure the way it works, there is a little wrench icon on the far left, and you can click that, and you'll see what it will search through if you type in a word. So right now, it's actually searching through practically everything. Applications, bookmarks, calculator, command line, contacts, desktop sessions, like for fast user switching. So any keyword that I type in that would relate to any of these things, it will respond to, or it will give me an option for that particular thing. A location. So if I typed in, you know, music, it would give me as an option my home/Klaatu/music folder. That's all turned on right now, and I could turn certain things off, certain things on, whatever I wanted to do. So that's cool. And then next to the wrench icon, there's a little waveform icon. And if you click on the waveform icon, that brings up essentially top in a GUI window. I guess not a huge reason for it, but it is kind of handy to have. So if you want to see what processes you're running, or you want to see what processes in a tree view that are being run, or just your own processes, or user processes, you know, just different, whatever you want, just the programs, lots of different options there to filter down what you're looking at. So it's really kind of cool, and you can kill them from there as well. So if Firefox has crashed on you, you could kill that process in a GUI way that way. So that's really neat. So KRunner is turning into a really, really proper power application. I'm enjoying that one a lot. I've been using that quite a bit. And I think that's about it. I mean, in terms of KDE 4.2, it's a really good environment. You know, it's very powerful. It still offers more options than I think any other operating environment that I know of offers. I can't think of any other environment as robust, as complex, and as configurable as KDE. So that's what I like about it. I really like that kind of power, where the user just gets to decide how exactly their environment is set up and how it reacts and what it does, and it's really good. There you go. KDE 4.2. It is KDE. It is the new KDE. It is an operating system that I can use proudly. I can show people and not apologize for little glitches. It's just a really well-done operating environment. Check it out if you have not. I know that it's in, I guess it must be in Fedora repos, unless I added some kind of testing repo without remembering, which is quite possible. I think it's in the testing of Kubuntu, although by the time I release this episode, it might be out in the official repos. So try it out. It's a real pleasure to use. Highly configurable, very powerful. Spend a little bit of time with it. You know, I like to shrink my fonts down because the default font size is a little bit large. I like to configure Dolphin so that it takes up a lot less screen real estate, things like that. But once you get it configured, that's it. You've got the exact operating environment that you want, and it's a pleasure to use. It looks really cool. I mean, hey, come on, Windows 7 stole it, so it must be good, right? All right, so enjoy 4.2. And congratulations, KDE team, for making an absolutely killer desktop environment. Debian 5.0 was released about 10 days ago now, February 14th, it was finally released. I guess it had been earmarked for release quite a bit earlier, if I'd recall. It might have been sometime last year, literally. It was almost around the time of OLF, I think. It might have been a little bit later, but it was last year, I'm pretty sure. And for whatever reason, they kind of shelved it for a while. They decided it wasn't actually ready. It must have been something very low level, not apparent to the users, because I've been using it since Ohio Linux Fest, Linny. I've been using Linny on my Triple E, and it's been running great for me. I've had no problem with it. And this is on my Triple E, so I take it out. I do everything with it that I do with any other computer, do animation on it, audio editing, just everything. I really, really use it. I'm not just checking email on it, you know? And it's been working great for me. So whatever issue they decided it had, I guess they've fixed it, and now it's ready to go. And I think for the first time However, I've actually seen on the Debian site, debian.org, an actual graphic. I literally, this might be the first time I've ever seen it. But yeah, they did a nice little, very attractive blue Debian 5.0 rounded square universal operating system. It's really spiffy. Looks really cool. And I mean, this is an exciting release for many reasons. Let's go through some of the little highlights. One of the highlights is that they've added another ARM port. It's the ARM, well, they're calling it ARMEL, A-R-M-E-L, and this is going to be a more efficient use of the modern current ARM processors as well as the future ARM processors. And ARM is a processor that seems to be going kind of hardcore. I mean, it's getting into a lot of mobile devices, obviously, getting into netbooks. It's starting to be, I think, from my impression, an important processor. Debian obviously has always had support for lots of different platforms, and we're talking quote-unquote official support. I mean, this isn't one of those things where you can kind of dig around and find someone's port of something to, you know, Spark or Alpha or S390. This is the Debian, the different Debian teams porting everything over to that processor. And yeah, it's Spark, Alpha, MIPS, PowerPC, which I use quite often, or used to use quite often, they're starting to diminish now. Intel, obviously, you know, 64-bit, all that other good stuff. So very cool. There is also they've got different desktops available for it, of course, but I mean it's GNOME 2.22, not 2.24, XFCE 4.4.2, KE 3.5.10. What's that? Yes, only 3.5.10. In order to get KDE 4, you have to go to experimental. They got GNU Step included, I think. OpenOffice 2.4, they didn't do the whole OpenOffice 3.0 thing. GIMP 2.4, they didn't do the whole 2.6 thing. Kind of funny stuff. I'm not really sure why they're so conservative on some of this stuff, but whatever. The important thing about Debian, I think, well, aside from the fact that it's the basis for Ubuntu. I mean, that in itself makes it a pretty significant thing. I mean, it's the basis for probably what is the most popular Linux distribution, at least that I've ever heard of, although I understand that Mendrivo was pretty popular back in its time as well, so who knows what we're talking about. But, I mean, I don't remember seeing a whole lot of stuff about Mandriva in the public media, whereas Ubuntu you actually do see in public media. But then again, when Mandriva was popular, there wasn't this sort of populist geek subculture that is kind of arising. I mean, as so many more people start carrying around little techie gadgets, it is becoming a lot more acceptable to be into the geekier things in life. That doesn't mean you actually have to have an understanding of them, but people are kind of looking around and being more interested in the geeky topics. So maybe that's part of why Ubuntu is popular as well. I don't know. So Debian, whether they like it or not, they're the basis for Ubuntu, so that makes them significant. You know, it puts turns a lot of eyes their way, I think. Could something else have been the basis for Ubuntu? Realistically, yeah, probably. I mean, honestly, it's probably not so much it's not because Debian is Debian. I mean, if Ubuntu could have done the same thing that they're doing now based on Red Hat or anything else, you know, it's still Linux, and the power of Ubuntu seems to be the fact that they can market, that they have a budget to market, that they have a budget to make little improvements here and there, you know, spit and polish kind of thing. So does it really have to be Debian? I don't know. I'm not convinced. So the really important thing about Debian, and okay, so here's another thing that's not that important, is Aptitude. Aptitude is great. Apt-get is great. People love it. People go crazy about it. People swear by it. I don't really see the big deal. I don't package myself, so maybe that's why I don't see the big deal. Maybe Debian is just, maybe the apt-get solution is just that much better than everything else out there. But then again, you hear certain people being that crazy about Pac-Man or Canary or whatever. It's just, I don't know, it's a packaging system. The general model of Linux, adding applications to Linux, being simply opening up a little application and finding what you want to find, and then clicking a button and it just pulls it off the internet and suddenly it's installed. I think that's a really effective one. I think it's really cool. I'll bet you anything a Mac user or a Windows user would just be blown out of the water if they realized it was that easy on certain systems. So the whole Aptitude thing, the apt-get It's nice. They've got 25,000, over 25,000 packages in their repositories. Yes, that is significant, but it's still not the most important thing about Debian. So what is the most important thing about Debian? The most important thing about Debian is that it is really, really free. It's actually just, it's an anarchistic project without a central source of leadership or sponsorship. It is something that it's a true community effort. People are coming together to make it happen. And I know that this is actually true for Linux in general, and it is. It's very true. Linux, if Red Hat died a horrible capitalistic death tomorrow, that would be fine. People would pick up the pieces of all the GPL'd code, and they would continue on with, you know, CentOS and Fedora and everything like that. Not a big deal in the long run. And Debian is the same way. If one of the contributors stopped contributing, their absence would be filled by some other developers. You know, so this is just a general Linux thing, but I think that Debian is important because it is. It's a major Linux project. It's dedicated to free software. It's not something that they, you know, they don't do the whole Ubuntu thing where they'll scan your system, find out what exactly you need, and then install all the restricted drivers for you and stuff like that, which is why Ubuntu is popular, because it does do that. But Debian will not do that, and they're committed to freedom. They're committed to independence and being honest with you know, their social contract is all about being transparent, not hiding their problems, being completely accessible to everyone and completely free. It's just an important thing to have in the Linux space. This, as opposed to, for instance, something like, I don't know, let's just pick on Zandros. Zandros, they are a clearly, you know, a commercial Linux. What else? You know, some of these netbooks coming out with weird little Linux variations that, you know, hide the terminal or something like that, or disable it entirely, stuff like that. These kinds of Linuxes, where it's just more convenient for the company to take the code and change it into exactly what they want, their little kiosk, and instead of giving users freedom, they're just using Linux to kind of create a new brand of lockdown. And now, obviously, for the geekier people, they're going to be able to get in there because the code is there, or they'll just wipe the drive and put a real Linux, you know, quote, real Linux on there. But the point is that if you don't have that kind of representation, if you don't have the big majority, the big group of people saying, yeah, this is our code, we're going to continue to develop it independent of any other outside force. There doesn't have to be a leader, a big leading a person. There doesn't have to be a Mark Shuttleworth or a big figurehead. It doesn't have to be a company, a Canonical or a Red Hat sponsoring us. We're just doing this because we want a universal and free and open operating system. That's an important precedence, I think, to set. And that's the message that Linux needs to push, which is why I respect Debian so much, and I enjoy using it on my EEE. And it's a really cool project, and you have to respect it for what it is. It's a robust and great, you know, just techie enough to get you interested in it, but not so raw that you have to sit there and do the whole Slackware thing where you're looking around the entire internet for dependencies and stuff like that. You know, it's just it's a good geeky distribution that's really fun to use, really nice, a little bit conservative, but really, really cool, and lots of different options. Lots and lots of different packages pre-built for you, so it's cool. Debian is really nice. It's a fun distribution, and check it out if you haven't already. You probably have, but if you're using Ubuntu or something like that, and you're ready for something a little bit geekier, Debian would be something to look at. It's going to get you into a little bit of the harder core tech stuff, while also keeping you within that sort of, well, obviously a Debian-based environment. So, yeah. Check out Debian Linny. It's a good one. Listener feedback. feedback. I've got lots of listener feedback, but I've got a lot to catch up on, so I'm just going to kind of go through some quickly. First of all, I should apologize to Ken Fallon, publicly apologize. I missed, he had written me, now it's been like probably a month ago, and I forgot to read his email out on listener feedback. And that, my friends, is the danger of doing listener feedback, because inevitably someone has given you feedback and you've either moved their email into another folder by accident, or you just miss it when you're reading through them, or or they gave you feedback on IRC and you think to yourself, oh, I need to mention that on my listener feedback, and then you forget in the moment. So that's the problem of listener feedback. But yes, Ken Fallon gave me feedback, and obviously, everyone knows Ken Fallon, so, I screwed him over. He'll probably never talk to me again, much less continue to listen to the show, but oh well. It was worth it. It was worth living on the edge like that. So, who did write me is Galactus13, which, frightening name, and he listens to the show. He really does. And he wants to be listener number 00. That's 00. So that's a pretty impressive request. So he gets to be listener 00. I admire someone writing in saying that they want to be listener 00. I cannot refuse that kind of request. Pixel Juice emailed me, and Pixel Juice is someone I've picked on in the past, but this time he's got some really cool stuff. He has a couple of different he has sampled a number of his drum machines, and so what he and I are going to attempt to do are kind of assemble some of these samples into an actual useful entity, as it were. You can grab them as well. He's got them up on a Dream Hosters site of his, so you can find it at benjarvis.org. That is benjarvis.org/audio/200_drum_machines.tar.gz. Okay, so obviously that's a lot of drum machine samples. It's, I think, the size of a CD. It is many, many megabytes. A lot of sound stuff. So you should look at that stuff. Hopefully he and I can maybe polish it up a little bit and get it into some kind of sensible hydrogen drum kit or something, but we'll see what happens. Point is that, yeah, it's a lot of great samples, and the deal with these samples is that they come off of drum machines that are being sold in stores, but as far as I know, and he and I have talked about this, and neither of us are lawyers, so we don't really know what we're talking about, but as far as we both understand, when you buy the synthesizer, you're buying the machinery and you're buying the sounds, and the fact that you are able to use these sounds in songs that you then give away or sell means that basically the sounds are royalty-free. They don't necessarily belong to you the way that GPL software belongs to you. Like, literally, you can take that code and do whatever you want to with it. But it is essentially the same. I guess it would be a similar kind of sort of a Creative Commons license in a way. You know, I mean, you can use the sounds. You may or may not need to give attribution to the or credit rather, or whatever that is, to where the sounds came from, but they are for general use. They're for royalty-free use. You don't have to go back and pay Roland or Yamaha or anyone like that. You don't have to pay them for the use of the sounds. It's just, that's, you bought the synth, you get to use the sounds. Whether we're supposed to be distributing them or not to everyone, I'm not sure. But again, I've never had issues with this sort of thing before, and I've traded back and forth sample banks with friends back when I was using hardware-based solutions, so I don't really see the difference. Of course, then again, I don't really see the difference between making a mixtape and making a mix CD for a friend either, but as we all know, there is definitely sort of a stigma around that concept as well. So maybe I'm just being a little bit too anarchistic in my views. I'm not sure. But he and I are going off the assumption that since we bought the synths, we can use the sounds the way that we would like to use them. Jonathan from Ubuntu Empire, Ubuntu Emporium, or whatever it's going to be called, his Ubuntu site, who's making computers with Linux installed, wrote me and said that he is actually taking classes on computer science now, which is really cool. Something that I would love to do. And, you know, he's a college student at this point, and he could probably use a computer upon which to code. And I was thinking for a while, well, maybe I should send him that MacBook that I've been trying to ditch onto some Blender developer. But then, the same week that he emailed me, and I was thinking about this, suddenly a Blender developer emailed me, actually a couple did, saying that they were interested in the Blender project. So, this is something that is actually starting to develop, and I will get onto that in a moment, I think. I will talk about that a little bit more. So, let's just say that that's back up in the air at this point. We'll see what happens with it. I'll give you an update in a moment. Let's see, who else? Oh yeah, Pixel Juice wrote me again about a subtitling program, which is kind of interesting, actually, because I don't know if you've ever seen, like, a fan sub for an anime show where, you know, just some random fan who has learned Japanese translates the entire cartoon and subtitles it for you. So really cool. But there is a subtitling program, and it's called AEGISUB. So that's aegisub.net. AEGISUB.net. I think it's a really fantastic program to know about. I don't know that I'm going to need it anytime soon, but in terms of amassing all the multimedia applications that one would need for Linux, this is a good one to know about. This is an important one to know about. Obviously, doing subtitles is really important for two reasons. Number one, if you've got a movie that you've done or that someone else has done that you want to translate into another language, having a program for subtitling is a good thing. And then number two, having subtitles or a subtitle option on something that you are releasing is really important because not everyone can hear. You know, people want to watch movies, and if they're deaf or hard of hearing, it really, really helps to have subtitles, or, you know, as they're called, closed captioning. Same idea. And this is something that just considering all potential users of your media, it's important to have that available to them. So, there you go. Ron emailed me 20,000 times, but one of his emails was an interview with Richard Stallman that some guy in Poland did. And it's actually a really cool little email, little interview, and I will try to remember to put the post on, the link on the site in the show notes. Can't guarantee that I'll remember to do that, but I will attempt to. But it's pretty neat because he, you know, Stallman is Stallman, but it's kind of neat because he's got a lot to say. And sometimes he's just kind of, dare I say, surprisingly sensible. Like, you read what he says and you're just like, yeah, the guy's right. The guy's got a good point. So it's kind of cool to look at, I think. Ron also wrote me about Adobe Air, and he asked me my opinion on Adobe Air. And I thought that was a really thought-provoking question, actually, because, well, number one, I never really thought about Air that much, the Adobe Air platform, and I'm not a programmer. So for me to comment on a development environment is kind of unfair, right? It's like a programmer coming to me commenting on video editing applications and telling me that, no, Linux is perfect for video editing, nothing ever needs to happen. It is exactly where it needs to be. Probably their basis for these opinions is not as valid as mine or whatever, you know? I mean, it's kind of like, what's your specialty again? Oh, it's not this? Well, then stop talking about it, as politely as possible. But, so I don't feel like I should comment a whole bunch about Air. I mean, obviously my first reaction is, well, the word Adobe comes before it, you know? Probably that is going to send up a red flag. I don't know about something coming from Adobe for Linux that I would really be that interested in, because I really am interested in free software. I'm not that interested in all these little proprietary solutions that people are trying to come up with. Air is kind of impressive because it does enable a certain degree of cross-platformedness. So, you know, you have Air and you can theoretically write applications for Linux, OS X, and Windows, and it will all work as long as they have that Air runtime environment, or whatever they're calling it, installed. Sounds a lot like Java. Java, I've never been that crazy about. I don't see why I would be that crazy about Air. The article that I've read on Air, which I just read after Ron asked me about it, was in Linux Journal, the one, I think, just from this month, the one with the Day the Earth Stood Still cover story on it. I don't know, it sounds like the development tools on Linux are lagging behind the other platforms. So already you're seeing kind of a Linux as a afterthought kind of attitude. So I don't feel that great about it. I don't know that it's that important. If cross-platformedness is your goal, I don't see the problem. And again, I'm not a programmer, so I could just be completely wrong on this. But the first place I would look is the Qt 4 tool set. Get whatever kind of license you need. If you're going to be selling it, use the commercial license. I guess they still have that. If you're not going to be, then use the free license. Code it in the language you know that works with Qt, whether it's C++ or Python or whatever, and release the thing that way. Compile it for OS X, compile it for Windows, and compile it for Linux, and suddenly you've got a cross-platform application that uses the same toolkit. And runs on all three major platforms, and you're done. And you didn't have to go to Java, you didn't have to go to Air. And you can't tell me that something developed in Air for something very specific that's going to interface with, I don't know, DirectX or Quartz, Core Graphics or whatever. I mean, it's not going to work as advertised on all three platforms. So I don't think that that's going to make much of a difference. I think if you've got really specialized applications that you're trying to do, it's going to be the same amount of kind of double coding in Air as it would be in, you know, C++ and Qt, whatever. So I'm not going to get that excited about Air. But then again, I'm not using Air. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But I would look at other solutions, free solutions, before I looked at Air. That's for sure. That I can say for sure, and I can say securely that I would do that. Let's see, who else wrote me? A couple of people wrote me about a blog posting on the Linux cranks that I had put up, and I basically said that proprietary software is not necessary on Linux, and it is certainly not killing Linux, because there was a blog post by someone else at some point saying that the 100% free software attitude was going to doom Linux to failure, which to me made no sense, since Linux is based on 100% free software and is successful using 100% free software, so I don't see why there would be any kind of doomed to fail thing about having 100% free software. I don't get that attitude, and I also get that maybe someone who would think that might have different goals in mind for Linux as people who would think otherwise. That I think is a possibility. So a couple of people commented back on that, some agreeing, some disagreeing, you know, typical kind of difference in opinions. And the important thing I think to realize about all this stuff is that we're all trying to improve Linux. That's the main goal here. Some of us are trying to improve it in one direction, and some other people are trying to improve it in another direction. But the point is that we all have the best interests of Linux in mind. And for as much fun and games as the Linux Cranks has on their show, on our show, you have to keep in mind that people are trying their best to improve and bring about a better Linux environment. And that's fair. And I might not agree with the way that someone's doing it. I might not agree on one thing or another, the philosophy of it or the style of it, whatever. But as everyone has said before, the big deal about Linux is the choice. And if you don't like the idea of a proprietary application on Linux, lucky for you, you don't have to run said proprietary application on Linux. It's just not something that you have to do. And as long as projects like Debian are out there, and Fedora, you know, things that are really committed to having free software only in their distribution, we've got that brand of Linux. We've got that brand of free Linux available to us, and we don't have to really sit around and worry about the whole proprietary thing getting into our systems. Do I think that everyone would be made a lot stronger if we really, really turned our back on proprietary software? Yeah, I do. That's why I turned my back on MP3. That's exactly why I don't release this podcast, this AugCast, in MP3. And it's why I don't release Fedora Reloaded in MP3. And it's why I'm not, and it's why Linux Cranks doesn't release it in MP3. We're saying we do not need this proprietary brand. We don't need what they have to offer. We've got our own solution. And yeah, I think that absolutely would make the community stronger. I think that if you say we don't need Photoshop ever, 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 we do not need your Photoshop. We don't need it to be ported via Air to Linux. We don't need it via Wine in Linux. We just don't need it. We have our own solution. Yes, I think that would be stronger because then people are going to be inspired to not only use GIMP, but also to develop GIMP so that it is even a better application than it already is. And that's how Linux is going to be strengthened, is when people divert their energy from porting a proprietary software over to Linux to just developing their own solution for the same job for Linux. That seems like it's going to be the way to go. All right, there are probably other comments, listener feedback things that I'm missing. In fact, I'm sure there are, but since I've been going on for a while, I'll just kind of call it quits here. But let's talk about Blender really quick, shall we? But first, let's do a segue music interlude so that we know that we're still in the show and getting to a new thought. A couple of months ago, I had the idea on Linux Cranks, or maybe it was on this show actually, that someone should take the existing Blender code, which is extremely stable and very, very robust, and kind of mix and match it and mix it up and cut and paste and all that other good stuff to make a professional style video editing application. Because as is, Blender does a really excellent job of editing video anyway. But there are a couple of little tiny features, or seemingly tiny features, that are just expected in a professional video editing application that if they're not there, they would just make people scoff at the idea of editing video in this application. Practically myself included. I mean, not necessarily, because I would rather use free software to edit my video without certain features than using proprietary software that includes certain features. But for the most part, I mean, it's nice to have some of these little features that you kind of come to expect from professional editing applications. And also, if you're going to push this as an alternative to proprietary software, I think you do have to have certain features, or otherwise people just aren't going to see it as a valid alternative. It would be like having GIMP without a selection tool or something like that. You know, it just people would not be able to take it seriously. So there are features that need to be added. There's interface changes that definitely need to be made, things like that. So I came up with some mock-ups, and I'll include a link in the show notes again to those mock-ups. And I announced the idea of having a developer work on this project on Linux Cranks and offered up a computer as kind of an incentive. And I talked to some developers, and a lot of people thought it was a good idea, but either they were too busy working on the next iteration of Blender, or it just wasn't for them, or they just didn't have time, or whatever. And so it was up in the air for a while. Now, I guess it was not this past week, but the week before, I actually got an email from a developer who is interested in working on the project. So this is kind of exciting news for me. And actually, right now he is drafting up, I would say, a proposal, I guess, sort of a kind of how long he expects it to take, how much code he thinks it will need to be written. He's hoping to do a lot of it just in Python scripting, because a lot of, I guess, button functionality and stuff like that can totally be just Python scripted, and this would really help with cross-compatibility among the platforms. Although I told him, in the end, just not to worry so much about cross-platform, and just to really make sure that we're just getting it right for Linux. And this developer has done a lot of Linux work in the past. He's done a lot of GPL work. He's done stuff for the OLPC, so he's not foreign or a stranger to Linux. So he's working on that kind of I guess, proposal or pitch or whatever right now, and I will be working with him in the near future to make this happen. So this is exciting news. This is something that is actually potentially going to occur. We'll see. I mean, obviously everything is kind of speculative until you actually have the code running on your machine. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what kind of time he has to dedicate to it. I'm hoping to get some money together to kind of make this more worth his while. I mean, it's really cool that he's coding this, and I know that it's free software and everything happens for free in the Linux world and all that other good stuff. And yet at the same time, since I am a user trying to scratch an itch and am completely unable to do so for lack of programming skills, I am going to be paying him some kind of compensation for his work. I figure if I'd gone out and had to buy a video editing application for Mac OS, I would be spending, X amount of dollars. So I'm going to be allotting quite a bit probably for him to be a dedicated worker on this project, simply because, yes, I could have it done for free over the course of a certain amount of time, and eventually I might have a working software product, or I can pay him and make sure that it gets done in a prompt amount of time. And time is a little bit of the essence, because I want to get a video editing application up and running that I really feel comfortable with, that is free, that is stable, that is flexible and robust, like what I would be used to on a proprietary platform. So if anyone wants to donate to this worthy cause, let me know. I won't be taking money, I don't think, yet until I see code. I mean, I don't want to spend anyone's money and have it mysteriously disappear, like certain other people have taken collections for, and you never really see where the money goes or anything like that. But if you want to donate to this this cause, let me know how much you want to donate, and I will let you know once there is actually code being written and stuff like that, and then maybe we can pool resources and give this developer some amount of money for his not just for his trouble, because I'm sure that he or some developer would do this for free anyway, but doing it in a timely fashion, I think, is worthy of payment, and I think good code is worthy of payment, and I think it's a good way to prove to the world that that free software can produce money. People can actually make a living off of free software, and this is one way of doing that, because I know that if I went out and bought a video editing application like Final Cut Pro, I'd be spending $1,300 at least. If I went out and bought Smoke from Autodesk, I'd be spending $70,000. So one way or another, there's going to be money spent, and I certainly don't expect anyone to sit down and write an entire stable video editing application for me. I mean, on top of the Blender code, but still, I mean, you have to work at it, I'm sure. I wouldn't expect that for free, and I want to give something back to this guy. So if anyone else thinks that they will be using this video editing application, thinks it'll be worthwhile, let me know. Okay, I think with all that excitement, this is the end of the show. Thank you for listening. Been episode 19 of season 3. That means there's one more episode in this season. Yep, and then I'll be in season 4 at last. If I decide to continue this show, who knows, I might just stop. Season 3 might be the end. You never know. You'll just have to wait and see. Hope you don't lose any sleep over it. So, yeah, this has been episode 19. I'm Klaatu. Need to email me, Klaatu at hackerpublicradio.org or Klaatu at linuxcranks.info. Those are my two good email addresses these days. And check out the website, thebadapples.info, for show notes and stuff like that. And that's about it. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.
SoStrong.com, your weekly trunkload of open source.